want to start this morning with a phrase coined by Thomas Jefferson. Almost 248 years ago, in our country, the preamble of the Declaration of Independence. And you may know it, it goes like this. It says, "We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their Creator with certain and unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." Life, liberty, and the pursuit of In declaring independence from England, the oppressive rule of England, Jefferson wrote these words, and he described them as unalienable. Unalienable. Easy for you to say. By unalienable, he means that these are basic rights that people are born with, which can't be taken away or even given. And so, with a start like this to our country, it's no wonder that our culture has such an expectation for being happy. And I think it's maybe safe to say we are happy addicts, happiness addicts, and our pursuit of happiness may just have gotten out of control. Our preoccupation with being happy and the high value we place on personal fulfillment and meaning in our lives drives so much of what we do. Jefferson's words have been inspiring people over a couple of centuries. And since the preamble ties these things directly to our Creator, right, it could cause you to assume that happiness is a biblical promise. Where is this guy going this morning? What is he saying? Do what makes you happy. That's a common phrase here in our culture. It sounds so good. It sounds incredibly right, right? It sounds like it should be right, but do what makes you happy is on the list of things that Jesus never said. And the purpose of this series is to find the true revelation of what Jesus said. And sometimes it's helpful to look back at what he didn't say so that we can embrace what he did say. And let me give you a few things before we dive in about how this works. So things that Jesus did not say, all right? Jesus did not say, go into all the world and preach whatever makes people happy. He did not say that. He didn't say, whoever wants to be my disciple must affirm themselves, avoid the cross, and follow their heart. He didn't say that. He didn't say that. This was my favorite. Jesus never said, ask and it will be given to you because God is your celestial sugar daddy. He's your cosmic Coke machine. No. You know, God never said that about our happiness. So today I want to look together at John's gospel. We've already read it. Christina read it to us. John chapter 8. And the first 11 verses, and I want you to visualize this picture of what happened. Jesus is out in the town square, and he's essentially leading like a Bible study. Like he's gathered some people around in the temple, and suddenly some hypocritical religious men drag a woman caught in the act of adultery, and they throw her down in front of Jesus. Like they interrupt the Bible study and everything. There's a couple of things that maybe before we go on that we need to talk about. One is, where was the man who was obviously left out of this story? Like, where was that guy? Like, that's a kind of a problem. I don't quite understand that. And secondly, how exactly did they catch this woman in adultery? That seems suspect to me. Like, what were they doing? And so that's a whole nother thing. We don't have time for that. But these guys, they bring this woman. She's caught in the act of adultery. And you can imagine if she was caught in the act of adultery, then it's likely that she is thrown down and she's barely dressed. And this would have been the lowest, most humiliating moment of her entire life. What's interesting is the men didn't seem to care about her. They're just using her as a tool. Because she was caught in the act of adultery, they were using her to get to Jesus, to try to trap him. We'll see that upcoming in the story. They made this woman stand before the group and said to Jesus, "Teacher, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. In the law of Moses, it commands us that we need to stone her." And imagine this idea of stoning. We're not talking about medicinal help here. We're not talking about these things. It's just like taking rocks and you're going to throw it at a person until they bleed to death. It is a horrible thing. And they say, Jesus, what do you say? Verse 6 shows us the motive behind their question. Because they were using this question as a trap. But Jesus appears to be in a no-win situation. Because if he agrees with this and says, yes, go ahead and kill her, then what happens is he loses his reputation for love, for mercy, for grace, for healing. If on the other hand he says, that's not that big of a deal, let's just make an exception here, it's okay, then he's breaking the law of Moses and apparently condoning the sin of adultery. So what is Jesus going to do? If you look at the end of verse 6, it says, but Jesus stooped down and wrote in the dust with his finger. And this is so interesting because Jesus kneels down, he starts scribbling some words in the sand, and it raises the question that everybody has asked throughout time, what did Jesus write in the sand? Was he drawing little pictures? What was he doing? The answer is we don't know for sure. We don't know exactly. We have some ideas, though. Many people think he was writing down the sins and the names of the men standing there, which is so awesome if that were true. That would be so good. We don't know for sure if it's true, but I tend to think it's likely because there's two different Greek words that can be translated to write down. All right, the one word simply means to write down, but the other word is that's used in this context is the word that means against. Against. So whatever Jesus wrote in the sand, it was something against something or against someone. Now I'm just visualizing this. I'm just trying to picture it in my mind because I think it helps us, right? Jesus is looking out at the Pharisees and maybe he sees Phil. You know, Phil the Pharisee. And so he's writing in the sand and he's writing something about Phil. He's kind of revealing to Phil, since I'm the Son of God, I know what's in your browser history. And it didn't take me too long to see what you were looking at last Tuesday. Maybe he's writing down the sins of those who are bringing an accusation. He's writing them all down against this woman and he's trying to help them see that there's something going on here that they're not aware of. Jesus straightens up and he says, all right, but let the one who has never sinned throw the first stone. Jesus' response here is so brilliant. It's so brilliant. It's so wise. It's so loving. He cuts through the false argument that they're bringing to him. And he says, yes, she should be stoned. She absolutely should be stoned. But he says, the one who is without sin, go ahead and throw the first one. Verse 8 says, again, Jesus stooped down and he's writing in the ground again. And what the Bible records is when the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one. Phil left first. And then, no, that's not true. I just added that. The older ones left first until Jesus was the only one left with the woman standing there. And Jesus straightens up and he asks her, woman, where are they? Where are your accusers? Has no one condemned you? He says to her. And she says, no one, sir. Then Jesus said, neither do I condemn you. It's a beautiful moment. But here is what Jesus did not say. Next, Jesus did not say, then neither do I condemn you. So now go and do whatever makes you happy. Go now and follow your heart. It doesn't matter what you do as long as you don't hurt anybody else. Go now and you do you. Boo. Do whatever makes you happy. Jesus did not say this. Here's what Jesus did say. He said, neither do I condemn you. Go and sin no more. The NIV records it as, go now and leave your life of sin. This wasn't a condemning, judgmental statement. This was full of love. And you can feel the urgency and go now, don't wait, you're free. Go now, don't wait, live a better life. Go now, don't wait, you don't have to live in shame anymore. I like to try to get into the minds of the Bible characters as often as I can, and I just think it kind of helps us. This woman who was caught in adultery, we don't know, we really don't have any idea what kind of woman that she was. Maybe she was just an evil woman who woke up one day and said, I'm going to go wreck somebody's marriage and I'm going to have as much sex as I can have. Maybe she was like that, but the odds are she wasn't. The odds are she was probably a decent, kind of a God-fearing woman. And I'm just sort of imagining her in our modern-day context today. And I want you to go with me because I think it helps us. I'm visualizing that she may have been in a marriage, but that marriage was falling flat. They loved each other a lot, but it went into a difficult season, and they were struggling. And maybe her husband took her for granted. He didn't appreciate her. Or maybe he was verbally abusive, or who knows, maybe even worse than that. So perhaps she goes and she gets a job and feels a little bit better about herself because she's working with all sorts of people, and one day she's interacting with this guy at work, and he's kind of fun, and they have a good conversation, and it's really nice. It's kind of innocent, but she enjoys it, you know? And then after a while, he starts paying attention to her. And she feels a little bit guilty about it, but it's still kind of innocent, you know? And he compliments her, and he appreciates her work, and he says, you did a good job on this, and it really makes her feel good. One day he notices her hair. Like, her husband never notices her hair. She even got highlights. He didn't even notice her hair. But the guy at work notices her hair, and suddenly she finds herself looking forward to interactions with him, and she doesn't really want to, but her heart kind of moves in this direction, and then he follows her on Instagram and starts liking and commenting on every post. Like, he's got fire emojis and heart emojis, and she finds herself liking this. She looks forward to seeing him during the day, and then one day they both stay late, and he opens up about his marriage, and he says his wife isn't so good. And then a few weeks later, he tells her, he says, I think I made a mistake. I shouldn't have married her. I wish I would have married someone like you. And then one day, he accidentally brushes up against her arm, and she gets all tingly. The tingly winglies. And then she wonders, was it an accident, or did he mean to bump into me? Maybe there's something there. And then she thinks to herself, he would make me happy. He would make me happy. And then she's got to talk to somebody, so she talks to her girlfriend, right? And her girlfriend says, girlfriend, you follow your heart. You follow your heart. You do what makes you happy. You do you, boo. Now, we don't know how it happened. We don't know how it happened, but it could have happened like this. And step by seemingly innocent step, seemingly insignificant decision, one after another, after another, after another, after another, after another, and she finds herself barely dressed in the most publicly shamed moment of her life. How did she get there? Why is it that so many of us, including me, give in to temptation so often? Why is it? The answer is, it looks appealing. Right? It looks fun. How many of you would agree that sin can be fun? Just go ahead, raise your hand. Raise your hand all the way. You guys, a bunch of you are like, I'm not raising my hand on this subject in church. Like, lightning is going to strike me. Listen, sin can be fun. The book of Hebrews says it's pleasurable for a little while. If you don't think it's fun, then you didn't do it right. Or you're lying. I don't know. It's fun. It's fun for a little while, but it will mess you up. That's the problem. It seems like sin will make you happy. But really, the reality is sin just makes you stupid. All sin at its core is a problem of our own self-will, a primary desire and motivation to have it our own way, to get what we want. See, the idea of, listen to me, church, the idea of following your heart can actually be disastrous. Here's what Jeremiah said about it, Jeremiah 17. The human heart is the most deceitful of all things and desperately wicked. Who really knows how bad it is? I can tell you who knows how bad it is. God himself knows how bad our hearts can get, especially when we rationalize, when we intellectualize, and when we justify our own behaviors based on what we think will make us happy. We live in a very relativistic culture, relativism. It's where we define truth by our own desires. In other words, there's no absolute truth, only comparative or qualified truth, based on what we think. You'll hear this all the time in our culture. You may hear, this may be true to you, but it's not true to me. That's your truth, but I have my own truth. You live your truth, I'll live my truth, and because there's no such thing as absolute truth, so I'm just gonna do whatever makes me happy. And here's the fundamental problem. Without a belief in absolute truth, then truth is defined by whatever makes me happy, whatever whim goes on in my heart and my life. And when the bottom line is my happiness, then happiness becomes the standard by which I judge my actions. Think about this. If it makes me happy, it must be good. If it doesn't make me happy, it must be bad. I know everyone says this is wrong, but how could something so wrong feels so right? You've experienced this before, so have I. You pursue something that you hope will make you happy, fill a void, but even after achieving it, even after accomplishing it, it's short-lived. The emptiness returns. You think to yourself, if I can just accomplish this, if I can just get more of that, then I'll be happy. Psychology actually has a term for this. It's called the arrival fallacy. The arrival fallacy. It's the commonly held illusion that once we make it, once we attain our goal, once we reach our destination, once we acquire enough possessions, once we achieve a certain status, once we achieve lasting happiness and fulfillment by doing one of those things, then we've got it made. Listen, it doesn't last. It's simply not true. Just look around at Hollywood. Look at the music industry and how people, they seem to get everything they want and then they crash. Or politics, fame, money, and power. It never ends up achieving happiness. Here's a Carrie Snow, she's a brilliant author. She said, the pursuit of happiness is a most ridiculous phrase. If you pursue happiness, you'll never find it. You see, happiness can never be the goal, you guys. Happiness can't be the goal because it's a mirage, it's a phantom, it's fool's gold. If it's the focus of your life, the purpose of your life to find happiness, you'll fail. True happiness only comes as a result. Everybody say result. Happiness comes as the result of pursuing something greater, something more powerful. Nowhere in Scripture is this better illustrated than the book of Ecclesiastes. I'm going to read a whole section of it. It was written by King Solomon, and it's one of three books that King Solomon wrote. He wrote the Proverbs, he wrote the Song of Solomon, which is a pretty spicy little book, and then you've got the Ecclesiastes, which he wrote later in his life, and he was struggling with all these things, like what is the meaning of life, and how does it work, and it seems like so much has been disappointing, and here's what he says in Ecclesiastes 2, 1 through 11. He says, I said to myself, come on, let's try pleasure. Let's look for the good things in life. But I found that this too was meaningless. So I said, laughter is silly. What good does it do to seek pleasure? After much thought, I decided to cheer myself with wine. And while still seeking wisdom, I clutched at foolishness. In this way, I tried to experience the only happiness most people find during their brief life in this world. I also tried to find meaning by building huge homes for myself and by planting beautiful vineyards. I made gardens and parks, filling them with all kinds of fruit trees. I built reservoirs to collect the water to irrigate my many flourishing groves. I bought slaves, both men and women, and others were born into my household. I also owned large herds and flocks, more than any of the kings who had lived in Jerusalem before me. I collected great sums of silver and gold, the treasure of many kings and provinces. I hired wonderful singers, both men and women, and had many beautiful concubines. I had everything a man could desire, so I became greater than all who had lived in Jerusalem before me, and my wisdom never failed me. Anything I wanted, I would take. I denied myself no pleasure. I even found great pleasure in hard work, a reward for all my labors. But as I looked at everything I had worked so hard to accomplish, it was all so meaningless, like chasing the wind. Chasing the wind means it's elusive. You think you've got it, and then you don't. Solomon writes for 10, you guys, 10 more chapters on this subject about the pursuit of meaning in earthly things. And this is the same thing that so many of us are doing in our lives right now. Like, we're jockeying for positions at work. We're looking for likes and validation on our social media, right? We're drifting from relationship to relationship and just trying to find something. We're stumbling into addictions and unhealthy patterns, hoping that a vacation, that beach body, that bank account, that something, whatever it is, will be the thing that brings fulfillment. And it doesn't work. I guarantee you, Solomon tried to find meaning in crazy things we've never even considered. Did you hear that list? Okay, none of you have ever accomplished all that list. But here's the thing. I'm not going to belabor the point. I'm going to skip right to the conclusion of the end of Ecclesiastes, because he comes to a conclusion after all this. I'll save you the suspense. Here it is, Ecclesiastes 12, 13, and 14. In the Message Bible, it says, the last and final word is this: fear God, do what he tells you. Do God, do what he tells you, and that's it. Give God the respect and the reverence he deserves as the creator of all things, creator of the world. He knows what will destroy you, and he knows what will make you happy. He knows a meaningful way and a joyful way to a fulfilling life. That's what the psalmist said in Psalm 16, 11. He says, you'll make known to me the path of life. In your presence is fullness. Everybody say fullness. Like, it's fullness of joy. In your right hand, there are pleasures forevermore. You guys, there is great pressure on all of us to pursue treasure and pleasure. It's all around us, but when we pursue treasure and pleasure and the pressure that it brings apart from God, we don't end up happy. We end up miserable. We end up dissatisfied. We end up worn out, frequently empty, repeatedly selfish, and habitually angry. We often lose ourselves in this pursuit. That's how Jesus said it. In Luke 9, 24 and 25, he said to the crowd in 23, he said to the crowd, if any of you who wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way, take up your cross daily, and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. And what do you benefit if you gain the whole world, but are yourself lost or destroyed? For so many of us, we think the problem is, like, the problem for us is we think that happiness and holiness are at odds with each other. Now follow me here. Deep down, some of us, somehow, we, because of our distorted view of what Christ represents and teaches, we tend to think you have to choose one or the other. You got to choose holiness or you got to choose happiness. If you choose holiness, then you're just destined for a life that is miserable forever. It's not true. If you follow Jesus, it's like, I'm going to have to be miserable. It's going to be terrible. It's going to be all. Listen, it's not true. Just the opposite is true. And this is so important. You got to get this. I've said everything I've said up to this moment to get to this. Here it is. Holiness isn't mutually exclusive of happiness. In fact, they are very, very related. They are interwoven, in fact. Holiness is the pathway to true happiness and joy. Let me say it again. They are not mutually exclusive. They are united. They are connected. Serving God, living for him, not for the things of this world, but for the higher things that are eternal. That this is the pathway to true meaning in life. And the reason, it's so interesting, the reason that pursuing our pleasures here on earth doesn't seem to work, it doesn't seem to work out, is because we weren't made for earth. You were made for heaven.